Try these two words on for size. Artificial intelligence. There's something about that term that inspires both wonder and apprehension, sometimes at the same time in the same people. The idea of smart machines that can think like we do, and maybe better, is fascinating enough to be a constant focus of science fiction. Think of the friendly robots and so all those movies and TV shows. But then also think of the dystopian futures where the machines take over. We'll shove the science fiction aside and talk about science fact and possibility this hour with the author of the book, The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence. It's the work of Amir Hussain, who's an entrepreneur, inventor, and the founder and CEO of Spark Cognition, Inc. He's been published in Wired, Forbes, and the New York Times, among others. This, The Sentient Machine, is his first book. Amir Hussain, welcome to The Exchange.
Jeff, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's good to have you. You still have a clear memory, I understand, of the first time you saw a personal computer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was, as I mentioned in the book, I was just about 4 years old, and there's not very much that I remember from that time, other than the fact that I had this encounter with a Commodore 64, which was, you know, a brand new home personal computer at the time. And my sister and I had gone to a friend's house, and we saw this Commodore connected to a TV, and I remember distinctly the game that was playing on the computer was Hangman. And that was my first exposure both to Hangman as well as to a computer. And what blew my mind was the fact that this computer was changing what showed up on the screen. You know, there was this fungibility to the experience, and up until that point in time, all I'd experienced was that you saw on TV what was sent down the airwaves, and you had really no say in what would show up. But here was this machine, and you could press on a few keys, and it would change everything on the display. So in my young mind at the time, the sort of light bulb went off, and I thought, wow, this is a machine that I can use to shape and create my own experiences and really impact, the reality of what I see. And that sparked a love affair that has lasted a lifetime, so to speak. So really, that was my first exposure to computers.
You know, the examples you give of the things computers can do, we're aware daily of the things they could do. But when you get off into some of the things we don't get exposed to on a daily basis, like Mandelbrot fractals, I mean, how big can they get?
Yeah, Mandelbrot fractals are basically a mathematical construct. It's a very simple equation that was originally put forth by the French-American mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot. And it uses this concept of imaginary numbers. But it's a small expression, just a small, tiny equation. But when you plot that equation out on a computer screen, it gives birth to this absolutely gorgeous, beautiful image, this sort of self-replicating or self-similar, rather, image that you can keep magnifying, and it becomes more and more beautiful and interesting. And you can actually magnify it all the way to infinity. I mean, computers have already calculated Mandelbrot fractals, which have been magnified to a size larger than the known universe. And this whole idea of being able to take a mathematical expression and applying to it the power of computation, taking a simple formula and then letting computers plot the reality of that formula and create something that's beautiful, that's non-repeating, that's unique, that's a joy to, frankly, visualize, and that can be larger than our known universe. That, to me, is just mind-blowing, and it's something that most mathematicians and maybe many students that are in high school or college would have been exposed to. But if you think about it in those terms, it really gives rise to this awe and wonder that sort of I've held close to through all my years.
It blew my mind as well, which is one of the reasons I wanted to ask about that. Now, on a personal note, you suffer from cluster headaches, as you point out, and I'm sorry to hear that, but how does the treatment of those provide an example of the limits of human thinking?
Well, you know, cluster headaches, for those who don't who aren't aware, and it's always my wish that very few people should be aware of the pain and suffering involved. You know, a lot of people focus on the word headache, and they're sort of like, okay, it must be a bad headache, or a lot of people refer to it as a migraine, which is a terrible headache, and more people have them. But cluster headaches are really at an entirely different level. And without getting into the medical details, let me just say that colloquially they are referred to as suicide headaches because they can be so tremendous. They saturate all the nerve centers for pain in the brain to a point where your brain can't compute more pain. There is no more pain to feel at that point, and they're absolutely terrible. Now, even though they're referred to as cluster headaches, that's not the name of a specific ailment. That's just a bucket term for a set of symptoms. And the actual causes of cluster headaches or of the manifestation of those symptoms may be varied. For all we know, it might be multiple illnesses. And this is what I refer to in the book as a bucket illness. And it's not the only one. There are many other kinds of bucket illnesses. And the reason why they're still largely not understood, well, partially is because, we need to continue developing technology, but also some ailments that not too many people suffer from simply don't get the human mind share, research focus from human researchers. And that's logical, because we should focus on things that more people suffer from, but it doesn't take away the reality of the pain and suffering that people that are experiencing the long tail of illness, the long tail of disease, still have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Oh, so perhaps if we could put this into the hands of artificial intelligence, we might come up with some remedies sooner than just having humans work on it.
That's the hope. That's the hope, certainly, for cluster headaches as well as a number of other ailments.
All right, back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk more with Amir Hussain about his book, The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence, AI and You, back here on the Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the inventor and entrepreneur Amir Hussain, who is also the CEO and founder of Spark Cognition, Inc. He's been writing longer and longer works over the years and worked his way up to a book this time about artificial intelligence called The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence. It's not the science fiction part, not the fear part, not the Matrix stuff. We're just talking about what exists now and what he sees the possibilities as being. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. But before we get too far into the details, let us acknowledge the fear. And you mentioned in the book that fear of things like artificial intelligence leads us to Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, among other things. How so?
That's absolutely correct. Mary Shelley refers to the practice of building something that might be sentient, that might be living, as the unhallowed arts. There's a fear that I think comes from the long-held tradition that, it is God's work to create, and anything that is sentient is something that belongs squarely in the realm of, God's works. So that's one part of it. Another part of it, of course, is the fear that, it might be possible for us to create something like this, but what happens if it goes out of control? And there are some serious works. For example, Nick Bostrom has written an excellent book called Superintelligence. He is a philosopher and sort of he thinks about existential risk, and he has laid out in his book several arguments around the risk that AI might pose. But at the same time, my view is that the answer to a lot of these issues and a lot of these questions around risk is not to pause or hold back on the development of artificial intelligence, but to invest even more time and effort and resources in developing safe artificial intelligence. And that's an area of research, an area of work that's continuing to grow and continuing to scale. So in general, I'm an AI optimist, And I do think that there are ways in which we can develop this capability, develop the science, develop algorithms to ensure a level of safety.
All right. Well, let's talk about the major level of fear, though, and why you don't share it. I mean, the general feeling, I think, is that the people who are concerned about artificial intelligence think that it'll become so smart it'll realize, well, hey, we don't really need the human beings around, so why don't we just we'll take care of them and instead of the other way around. You don't share that fear. I mean, when you talk about safe artificial intelligence, what do you mean?
So safe artificial intelligence is an area of research now in AI that's becoming more and more active, thankfully. And this investigates how we might create algorithms, techniques, safeguards that are inherent in the technology that would, you know, prevent the misuse of AI, that would prevent negative outcomes in the event that the system malfunctions, that create this sort of layer of safety around AI technology. And there are many, many different ways to do that, and more are being worked on and discovered as we go along. And the rate at which progress is taking place in that area, and even my own team and what we do at Spark Cognition, what we've been able to develop in that area thus far, the practicality of progress in that area of safe AI is one of my reasons for being optimistic. I think there are ways in which we can address some of the issues around malfunction, some of the issues around misuse.
So let's talk about AI itself and machine learning and cognitive computing and pull some of these terms apart.
Yeah, absolutely. So artificial intelligence, you know, has been part of the science of computer science for a while. In fact, in the mid-50s, there was a conference organized at Dartmouth that involved several computer scientists, mathematicians, logicians, that all got together over a summer, the famous summer conference at Dartmouth. And they figured, well, you know, computer science is progressing so quickly. We're building all these digital computational systems. It's not going to be that hard to come up with algorithms that will allow machines to think. And probably over the summer, we can come up with some technology that would be able to solve, you know, serious problems that would otherwise require a human mind. And by the end of that conference, we got two things. One was the founding of the science of artificial intelligence, and Professor Marvin Minsky was a participant at that conference, and he's one of the fathers of AI along with John McCarthy. But at the same time, we also got the realization that, in fact, it wasn't that simple. It was going to take significantly more effort than a summer at Dartmouth to come up with intelligent algorithms. So that's how AI was born. Now, AI overall concerns itself with intelligent algorithms. And there are loose definitions for what that means, but generally, algorithms or programs that do the job that otherwise would require a human brain. You know, so for example, for the longest time, chess was something that that only human practitioners could play well, and computers couldn't beat, say, a human grandmaster at chess. And that all changed about 20 years ago when IBM's Deep Blue computer was for the first time able to defeat a human grandmaster, Garry Kasparov, at chess. Now, up until that point in time, people thought that chess required real intelligence, and there are many legends around how, you know, emperors and generals practiced strategies over a game of chess, and that it was so instructive to them in their real-world decision-making. But at the same time, when computers solved it, then we saw comments like, well, you know, it was just basically like a big calculator, there wasn't too much to it, you know, it was brute force. So the history of artificial intelligence also shows us that as intelligence is decoded and as activities that we thought require human intellect can now be done by a computer, and in many cases much better than a human can do those same things, we go back with this revisionism and we say, oh, well, that obviously doesn't require intelligence. So that's sort of been the moving target that AI has had over time. And let me pause there before I go into machine learning and cognitive computing. But that's been one of the more interesting things that sort of I've observed over many, many years. As soon as computers can do it, it's just algorithmic, obviously. Not you know, smarts weren't required.
Right. So a bit of backpedaling from people's like, oh, that's not really learning. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so one of the areas now within artificial intelligence that's taken off really in the last several years is this area of machine learning. Now, machine learning is a subfield of artificial intelligence. So again, artificial intelligence, overall the science concerned with intelligent algorithms. And machine learning is the subfield of AI that concerns itself with techniques that exhibit that intelligence, but that they learn from data. And not all of artificial intelligence is comprised of techniques that learn from data, but machine learning is that subset of AI where we are focused on developing algorithms and techniques and recipes where we learn from data. For example, you can take a huge number of pictures, and these pictures might show, cats and dogs. And you might expose them to a machine learning algorithm, and by the end of it, after having seen tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of these pictures with labels that specify what was a cat and what was a dog, now the algorithm has learned the differences between a cat and a dog. And if you show the algorithm an unseen picture that wasn't part of that training set, a new picture, then the algorithm would be able to make a determination with very high probability that what you've shown it is in fact a cat or a dog. And that's called a classification problem. So machine learning, again, is that subfield which is concerned with learning from data. And now in this area, we've had sort of a renaissance over the last several years, and deep learning is one of the techniques that has enabled that renaissance. And we've seen tremendous progress, facial recognition, the ability to take audio transcripts and with high reliability transcribe them as text, voice recognition, in other words, or video recognition, so applying image recognition at high speed. These are all perception problems where you look at data and you perceive it and you decompose it into individual objects and things and words. And that's an area where machine learning and deep learning in particular have been tremendously successful. So much of this AI renaissance, as of this point in time, has been focused on machine learning-powered perception capabilities.
All right, so we're talking to Amir Hussain here on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence. You can join the conversation, share your thoughts, your fears about AI with us here on the Jefferson Exchange, and we'll hear what the doctor's thinking about it, what Amir is thinking about this. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So does AI mimic how we learn, Amir?
Yes and no. So, I was talking about machine learning and deep learning in particular. Well, deep learning is a technique that's applied to a computational structure that we in AI refer to as an artificial neural network. And, of course, the word neural or neuron would be familiar to many who have heard that word in the context of the human brain. The human brain, as you know, is comprised of a huge number of neurons. Now, artificial neural networks are inspired by the design of the human brain, but only barely so, in that they are also a network of these neurons, but simplified neurons compared to what happens in our brain. And given that that's the case, that's where the similarity really ends, because humans learn in ways in which current deep learning techniques that are deployed at large scale don't do so well. So I'll give you one example. You can give a young child, actually, an example. You can give them a couple of examples, and in general, they'll use those examples to figure out the difference between, the cat and the dog, to go back to what I was talking earlier. You don't show them 100,000 pictures of cats and dogs. And most neural networks, artificial neural networks, still require a lot of data. Now, there are new techniques that practitioners of artificial intelligence are pioneering, and one of those areas is this field called learning by example, where you don't have to rely on massive quantities of data, and you can start with a few examples, and the machine can then imply. There are also areas such as reinforcement learning, which is an area that was used by the AlphaGo system to defeat the human grandmaster in the game of Go. So we're moving beyond the need for huge amounts of data, but most of the systems that are deployed today commercially that are part of this AI renaissance are still dependent on, you know, massive quantities of training data.
Let's bring a name in here, Geoffrey Hinton. What did his work add to AI, artificial intelligence?
So Professor Hinton has made some of the most massive contributions to the area of artificial neural networks and deep learning. And, I mean, one of the things that he solved was this issue of artificial neural networks not being trained effectively. So, you know, in the past, even though neural networks have been around for a long time, the training algorithms involved in feeding examples to the network, having the network learn from those examples, and with additional examples, increase its accuracy. That's really the goal. But with previous work, that accuracy wasn't very high. So, you know, you could train up a network, and then let's say it was a speech recognition network. And then you would speak to it, and it might have, say, 95% accuracy. Now, 95% sounds really high, but when you're speaking to a speech recognition program and 5 of every 100 words is incorrect, that's just not usable. You know, people just give up. So Professor Hinton was able to develop techniques that increased the accuracy of that whole learning process and increased the accuracy of what a neural network could exhibit once that training process was complete. And it was, in fact, his work that led to deep learning. And we owe a huge debt of gratitude to him for this new AI renaissance.
Amir Hussain, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence. So I mean, have we gotten, I noticed that I almost wrote a question about the reasoning of AI. I mean, have we gotten to the point where we do think the machines can reason, or is it just that they are repeating what they've learned?
Well, you know, of course, there's a lot of semantics involved here, like
sure.
What is reasoning? But I'll give you, again, a very tangible, concrete example. Earlier, I was talking about showing, a machine, an algorithm, many pictures of dogs and cats.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one way of differentiating between these pictures would be for the algorithm to simply memorize all the pictures of cats and all the pictures of dogs. Now, that would be an acceptable technique if the only thing you ever showed that algorithm to test it was pictures that it had already seen, in which case it would have these two stacks, if you will, in memory, and it would go through both of those stacks and say, okay, well, this new picture, is it something I've seen before? And when I saw it before, was it a cat or was it a dog? That would be sort of a rules-based approach and a memory-based approach, where there would be no real learning. It would just be sort of what we refer to as rote memory, right? I just remember what I've seen. And in human context, what we would refer to as reasoning would be to say, okay, so I showed you some examples. Now I'm going to give you something that you've never seen before, and now tell me what you think of that. Now, that can't just be solved with memory alone, because, again, that picture that you're asking the algorithm to classify as either a cat or a dog picture was never seen by the algorithm before. So even if it looks for that in memory, it won't find it. So to me, that is an example of basic reasoning, where you didn't just memorize all the pictures, but you got the essence of the pictures. You got the essence of what it means for a picture to, you know, show a dog, or what is the difference between a cat and a dog. It's not that simple. You know, they have 4 legs, they have a tail, they have ears, and they have roughly the same body structure. So there's obviously finer differences. And these algorithms are able to figure that out. Now, that's just one area. There are many other areas where, using other techniques, algorithms and machines are able to reason. They can come up with decisions, and they can lead you to outcomes that you've never taught them about explicitly before. So there aren't any hard-coded rules that they're using to do this. They're actually learning from the information.
Taking what they've learned in the past and able to extrapolate some new answers to new questions from that. Before we go to the break, and as we're getting close here, Amir, are governments regulating or doing anything to otherwise restrict the efforts to develop AI further?
There isn't anything there isn't a law so far, if you will. But there is a movement, particularly in the area of autonomous weapon systems powered by AI. And a large number of groups now are getting together to ask for everything from bans to regulations and so on and so forth. So there are active movements, but no law yet.
Okay, we'll take a couple of calls here. We have a couple waiting, and we'll take more as well to talk to Amir Hussain about the sentient machine here on the Jefferson Exchange. It's about artificial intelligence and what we think about the thinking of machines and what it can do for us in the future. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or by email. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Amir Hussain and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the inventor and entrepreneur Amir Hussain, who is the founder and CEO of Spark Cognition, Inc., a company working in artificial intelligence. He's written a number of articles over the years about AI, and now he's written a whole book called The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence. He is an optimist. You may not be. Let's hear your thoughts about artificial intelligence and what it can do for us and your concerns about what it could do to us. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take some calls, starting with Vajra in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Yes, I would just like to point out a couple of things. One is the abuse that is already happening with artificial intelligence, with the obvious things like the sex robots, which are primarily for men. Most women don't want a sex robot, which just furthers the disconnection of human being to human being and one human being to their own body. We have barely tapped in to what the capacity of the body-mind and the intelligence of emotions, and how we really function as a human being, and where we could go as human beings. And yet now, coming up with artificial intelligence, well-named artificial, and what I'm hearing here is not a sentient being. That's a misnomer to call it sentient machines. This is thinking without feeling, or learning without feeling. And one thing, the question I want to pose to your guest is, how can you safeguard against the people who want artificial intelligence to preempt or surpass or replace human beings? And I'm speaking specifically, I'll give an example, Martine Rothblatt, highly involved in the artificial intelligence movement, highly funded, and very rich person. And he speaks of, transgendered male to female, speaks of fleshism, and that someday we'll consider fleshism another form of racism. And this person, Martine Rothblatt and several others in the artificial intelligence field, want to upload human consciousness into computers so that you can live forever. And it completely disregards the plasticity of the human brain and the human being, real learning that's, you know, holistically involved, mm-hmm. real evolution of a person's spirit and soul and emotions. So I'd like to know, how can we safeguard against people who want to replace human beings and cyborg the body?
All right. Thanks for that, Vajra. Appreciate it. Amir?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I understand, the concerns. I understand that there is a sanctity that we all feel that is, associated with the human body and humanity, and we don't want to violate that, absolutely. And nor should we work in a way that looks to violate that. So I'm not very deeply familiar with the work of the individual that your caller cited, but I am familiar with the general discussion around uploading consciousness and so on and so forth. So let me just say that in just very practical terms, right, because there's two ways to respond to this. One is the philosophical and of course, it involves concerns around religion and spirituality and so on and so forth. But the other is the very, very practical. And let me just take that route for a second. We are not close to uploading somebody's consciousness into a machine. There are works underway now, serious works, that look to determine how the human brain really, really operates. And one project in particular is a project that's being run by Henry Markram in the EU. And he was funded, his group was funded to a significant degree, over €1 billion, to really understand how the brain works. And the value of that work is multifaceted. A, we extend our knowledge. B, we understand how the brain works. So many of the ailments of the brain, many of the issues that we encounter that currently have no solution, this work benefits all of that. But again, even such advanced, well-funded projects are nowhere close to uploading somebody's consciousness into a machine. So I think this is a discussion that society has time to have, and it's something that citizens should participate in, and I'm a huge proponent of that. In fact,
huge proponent of the discussion, you mean?
Of the discussion, absolutely. I think the discussion should happen, and I think this is the right time for both sides, and there might be more than two sides. I mean, there might be many points of view here, but for all those points of view points of views to come out, because this is the artificial intelligence century. A lot of the technology that we're going to be developing in many different areas will be powered by AI, and AI will have a massive impact on the world. And it's only fair and it's only right that it should be done in context of a large, significant global conversation.
Let us take another call. We have Sheila in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Amir Hussein, the author of The Sentient Machine.
Thank you. I really appreciated the last caller. I don't think I can beat that. I wanted to ask about, he's never mentioned the unconscious in the human brain, and so much of the human brain in humans involves the unconscious, and I wondered how that fits in with artificial intelligence.
All right, thanks for that, Sheila. Appreciate it. This might be a good time, Amir, to talk about Led Zeppelin and why it's mentioned in the book.
Absolutely. So one thing that I can sort of reference here is, you know, psychologists have done a lot of work, neuroscientists have done a lot of work in trying to figure out, you know, what's going on in the human brain and how many processes run in parallel in the human brain and how many we're conscious of that we're controlling actively and how many happen unconsciously. So I can be walking and chewing gum and having a conversation all at the same time. And to some degree, I'm not consciously walking. I mean, I sort of know where I'm going, but I'm not consciously controlling every muscle and directing it, you know, by force of will. It's sort of just happening. So clearly, there are many unconscious processes or subconscious that run in parallel in the brain. And there's a wonderful book by Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel laureate. And the book is called Thinking Fast and Slow. And this book characterizes our thinking into two patterns. System one, which is sort of just immediate responses, that is sort of subconscious, unconscious decision making. And then system two, which is the slow, labored thinking, where we're actually reasoning through things on an active basis. So there is work being done here. And, you know, this sort of study of what happens in the brain all in parallel and what we directly control and what sort of happens on its own, you know, these things are studied. And in the book, I also mention Kahneman's work. I also mention System 1 and System 2. And the Led Zeppelin example that you're talking about, which is really an example of how the human brain works based on an associative memory. So the example that I share in the book is that, you know, I really got into Led Zeppelin, the band, when I was at UT Austin. I was a student at UT Austin and some years ago, and I started sort of checking out the Led Zeppelin LPs at the university library, and that whole experience for me is recreated when somebody just says Led Zeppelin, because that's how I experienced it. So all of my memories, all of my experiences around my introduction to Led Zeppelin is stored in my associative memory, and all of those things come back. And all of us have had some, such examples. Led Zeppelin, for most people, doesn't have anything to do with UT Austin or a library.
Right.
But in my mind, it does, you know. And that's how we're exposed to experiences. And some of this is not active control. It's just happening because that's the way the brain works, associative memory. Now, there are associative memories in computers also, by the way. So, again, there's a lot of brain inspiration, but that's not to say that we're replicating exactly the human brain.
So, I mean, are people actually trying to get emotions into computers, or is that just too complicated a task at this point?
Again, the problem with things like this is, you know, emotions and this whole idea of subjective experiences. You can only know your own, right? You can't know somebody else's. So the subjective experience issue is a very complex issue, but in general, emotional inputs, which are essentially what are emotions at some level, they're emergent phenomena. We are sad because there are a whole number of biological processes running below this perception or this compound concept of sadness, this emergent concept of sadness. And when all those things get triggered, or many of them get triggered, or some of them get triggered to a high degree, then we are sad. So this idea of emotions being an emergent phenomenon, yes, there are emergent phenomena in complex mathematical constructs, in physics, in computer science. Whether you want to call them emotions, or whether you want to call them inputs, or whether you want to call them, again, emergent properties of a system, and how you deal with the question of this sort of subjective experience, these are all areas that are actively being debated and people are talking about. But I will tell you that the practice of artificial intelligence, when I go to work, when I work with teams building AI systems, we don't start with philosophy. You know, we don't start with wondering how we can implement sadness or happiness in a system. What we're focused on are more practical concerns. Like, this is the extent to which we can automate a process today with current technology. And beyond this, we require some elements of domain-focused, specialized human intelligence. How can we take some of that and have the machine, take over those responsibilities or augment the human that is a part of that sort of workflow? Right. So it's much more practical concerns than starting off with the question of, how do I build a machine that can be sad and happy?
Let's take a final call here from Phil in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Amir Hussain, the author of The Sentient Machine.
Yes, it's a fascinating conversation. I think you're going to run out of time. You should probably invite Hussain back again. Anyway, my comment is this. The previous caller mentioned about subconscious thinking and conscious thinking. And it dawns on me that my whole life I've been blitzed with commercial advertisements for one product or another. And it dawns on me that there's already a science of artificial intelligence in the sense that there's people working on ways to convince me that this product is better than that product, and to a point where I identify with the brand. And that's branding, which is a form of artificial intelligence in the sense that it's being transmitted from a commercial into me.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take my comment off the air.
All right. Thanks for that, Phil. Appreciate it. Thoughts, Amir?
That's a very, very interesting comment. And there's an entire chapter in the book called Mind Hacking. And the whole point of that chapter is to say that artificial intelligence techniques such as natural language generation, in other words, the ability to algorithmically, using a computer program, generate text written for human consumption, those sorts of techniques and algorithmic psychographic profiling, where you can read something that somebody's written, perhaps on social media, and use that data to develop a psychographic profile of the individual and then marry these technologies together at scale. Now, these are all real technologies that exist today. So this is the reason I love this comment is because it's talking about what exists now, what's being worked on now. And in that chapter, Mind Hacking, I also talk about this not just in the context of advertising, which I do reference and mention, but also in the context of political campaigns, also in the context of how we need to think about shaping public opinion in the future. I also talk about the recent election and, you know, this discussion in the press around, was it influenced by the Russians? Was it not? Were there bots on Twitter that were active for either side that were influencing the outcome? And what do we have to look forward to in future as we wonder about the future of democracy, for example, or the future of how one shapes public opinion and the traditional ways of doing that and the ways of doing that in the age of AI? So this is a tremendous comment, and there's a lot behind this. Like I said, entire chapter in the book dedicated just to that thought.
Do we let science fiction scare us just a bit, Amir, do you think?
We can't help but be scared, right? We have this thing in the back of our brain that some neuroscientists refer to as the reptilian part of our brain, which is the amygdala. And it's a structure that is there to, cause concern when things are sort of weird.
We got that going on in spades for sure. The book is called The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence. It is the work of Amir Hussain, who's been our guest today. Amir, thank you.